What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We're going to spend the hour today looking at cities where Trump has sent the guard and ICE and where Trump is threatening to send the guard and ICE. We start with Chicago, where last week ICE agents and the National Guard engaged in violent conflicts against the people of Chicago, so much so that a judge issued an order that ICE agents must wear body cameras before engaging the people. We'll see how that goes. Joining us to discuss is Damon Williams, a movement builder, organizer, performing artist, educator, media creator, and co-director of the Let Us Breathe Collective, an artistic activist organization birthed out of the Ferguson uprising. What's happening, Damon? Good morning.
Hey there. Good morning, Kat. Thanks for having me back on.
Glad to have you back on. And what I'm going to say, it out loud to my producer here, is that we do resistance and residence, and brother, you got to come on and be a guest for that. I want to hear about your artivism. We're going to have to get into that. We got to have a little levity on the show every now and again, you know? Damon, when we last spoke, agents were on the ground. They had executed a raid in a housing complex in South Shore. Am I saying that right? South Shore? Yeah. South Side? South Shore. Okay. You got the South Side, South Shore, you know, your neighborhood, your Alders. I get confused. And been targeting Black people, right? And part of why I want to continue to highlight Chicago, in addition to the fact that we consider that our sister city, is that it is one of the clearest places where we can look to see that Black folks are targets in this moment as well, which is a conversation being disappeared by mainstream media and, quite frankly, by some parts of our movement. Can you walk us through some of the events? But it seems like things escalate. They were there. Things were getting a little tense. Mm-hmm. But things definitely seem to have escalated last week. I wonder if you can walk us through some of the events of last week where protesters were attacked, including a young man that was wrestled to the ground. Walking out of a store.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to track, honestly, and to keep up with all of it, but we're seeing people being handled violently all over the city. We're seeing folks pop out in unmarked cars. We're seeing folks pop out in masks and really bring a level of terror to communities that are, you know, it is affecting obviously the Black community as well, but, you know, want to center what's happening to the Latinx and immigrant population of, you know, in talking to organizers or in talking to arts programmers, they're saying we can't hold our events anymore because it is unsafe and an unfair ask to ask people to come out of their homes. And so, yeah, throughout the city, in addition to that raid, we are also seeing Black people and unhoused people and vulnerable people and especially politicized people in protests being manhandled, being assaulted, being abused, being attacked with chemical weapons. And, you know, there is no immediate end in sight for sure.
And I want to be clear, too, when I'm talking about Black people, I'm also talking about Black immigrants.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely. We got Haitian folks. We got Afro-Caribbean folks. We got, I don't know, you, my Trinidadian community is out there. Pretty tough. I was going to talk about this later, but one of the other things that we touched on, I think, was really important was efforts that were being made to bring together the Black and brown community to form united resistance in this moment. How's that going?
It's going well. There are Know Your Rights trainings all over the city. There are rapid response networks, and folks are deploying when ICE is in, you know, vicinity to help support, to help document. I'm seeing a lot of efforts of mutual aid also for folks who don't feel comfortable or feel safe leaving their homes. What does it look like to have grocery store runs or other supplies to people to help protect them? And so, you know, again, solidarity is an ongoing project and it is never complete or perfect. But I think this time of attack is really strengthening, especially the politicized, organized community's connection.
I do want to shout out real quickly the Black newspaper, The Tribe. That's where I'm getting a lot of my information. And when they can, I mean, I know that they like us, they're sort of shoestring. But when they can, they are for folks in Chicago, following Chicago, they are collecting reports from community and sort of doing a roundup of what is happening in the streets. One of the things that's happening in the streets is not just the raids, the attacks on community by the agents, but also it seems like what, dare I say, is a pretty effective rapid response. It seems like the agents are attacking people and then there's a crowd of people there. Am I reading that right?
I think you're reading that accurately. Yeah, all over the city, you know, we can't catch everything, but every day I'm seeing a really beautiful response of, you know, obviously there are folks who are trained and folks who are, you know, looking for this, but then just everyday folks who are taking a stand and understanding that this isn't right and that, you know, it is also my responsibility to be present in this moment. And so, yes, I think that's an accurate read. I think every day people are under attack. There are attempts to kidnap people. And every day there has been community response and at least slowing that, at least documenting that, you know, in addition to, you know, just wanting to de-arrest people or stop the encounter from happening. One of the tragedies of this is that people are being disappeared with no documentation, with no ability to communicate with family or with loved ones. And so at minimum, to be able to have an image or footage or to be able to send out, does anybody know who this is? So that there can be understanding and communication in real time to help, you know, keep people connected to their families as best they can during these trying times.
How many of those rapid response networks, approximately, I'm not asking for like an exact number, but if you were to, you know, guess, are being born out of actual organizations and versus or in addition to, not versus, in addition to just sort of the people are like, yo, you, me, you and you, who's going to this corner and this is what's happening?
I would say it's probably about 50-50, which feels like a cop-out answer.
No, it's fair enough.
There are organizations such as OCAD, Organized Communities Against Deportation, ICER, I forget what that acronym is, and the Autonomous Tenants Union that have been doing this work for a decade or more. And so one of the learnings we have in movement is that, you know, often in the times of crisis, the people that we turn to are the people that have already been doing the work before the air quote crisis became obvious to us all. And so they have been a phenomenal foundation of organizing, not only in training folks, but in developing resources. The organization ICER has been working to your point, to not only center Spanish-speaking immigrant communities, but to have translations of all their resources in French for Haitian populations, in different West African languages and East African languages. And so there has been, in a way, like a global solidarity on our local scale that I've been seeing in practice beyond what has been executed before.
You mentioned the Tenants Association or the Tenants organizing group. Mm-hmm. Out here, one of the things that we've been looking at is the complicity of landlords in some of this, the snitching to ICE or the opening up apartment buildings to ICE or the National Guard. Are you all enduring that dynamic in Chicago as well?
I read reports that the landlord was complicit or collaborated in that raid in South Shore that you mentioned that was so horrific and happened in the middle of the night. So, yeah, that definitely lines up with what's happening here. You know, we are seeing rapid gentrification. South Shore specifically is a place for heightened speculation right now. It's just a few miles south of the soon-to-be-finished Obama Center. There's also an investment in what is called a quantum computer, which is this massive project that we can't go into in detail right now, but on it is this supercomputer, as well as a data center, as well as the Department of Defense and DARPA and IBM are really trying to build this like digital militarized mega campus on our lake on South Shore. And so with that, every day residents are getting calls from speculators and investors trying to buy up their property. And so for such a landlord to comply, to get people removed from their building, lines up with some of the gentrifying economic turns that are happening in the city.
You're right. We ain't got time to get into it right now, but we are going to have to get into that. What is that called again?
It's called the Quantum Campus. PsiQuantum is the lead tenant. It is on the former U.S. Steel Southworks site. It's a land that is highly contaminated, and so even the construction is going to be an environmental justice catastrophe that can potentially poison that nearby community. It's a project that's spearheaded by our governor and basically every level of government, including our university systems. And so it's one of danger. It's one that is also has the fear of decryption technology that will increase surveillance, and people are really afraid of the displacement and the water usage and electricity usage and just the environmental hazards that are coming out of this development that can start construction any day now.
So your governor kind of like our governor. On one hand, he popping his collar in front to fight Trump, but on the other hand, he's still waging war on poor people, marginalized people, and folks, black folks, and others.
That's accurate. It's hard to account because, you know, wanting to be fair, as someone who, you know, my revolutionary roots, I don't try to cheer for any elected official.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna be, you know, accurate. He has had some really important progressive fights and been on the right side of things, but he is a billionaire, and he is a billionaire with presidential aspirations. And so with that, that there is, in terms of taxation and in terms of this project, he does have a class solidarity or a capitalist outlook. And so even though, he's standing up to Trump right now in ways that can be appreciated, and he has supported some valuable organizing efforts throughout the state, at the end of the day, he's a fat cat.
Yeah, there's those of us that are really trying to hold that dialectic with our governor too. We're like, okay, great, right? You've turned into a superhero with good memes, clapping back at the Trump, and you're also withholding funds from cities that won't sweep our unhoused relatives. We ain't gonna forget, Gavin. We ain't gonna forget. We're gonna.
And Newsom and Pritzker are two of the names that are coming up the most in terms of who the Democratic Party is looking for 2028.
That 2028 run, yes, sir, yes, sir. So, another level of frustration I'm having out this way, and I'm trying to work through it, to your point, in a principled way, from an organizing standpoint, right, is who our elected officials are choosing to be in relationship with, and who they're choosing to be in relationship with is not necessarily the folks that got the ear of the people, right? It's who they feel are safe and probably who they feel are going to do what they say, as opposed to doing what is necessary in the moment. That is not the read I get from your governor. I know for a fact that he went and kicked it with my brother, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. There's a beautiful picture of them in the tribe renaming, holding the street sign for Chairman Senior. I'm interested in the extent to which grassroots, and still, right, there's the role of the state, right, progressive or otherwise, and then there's the role of the people. To what extent are grassroots organizations working with the mayor's office or other elected officials? Is it a shared strategy? Is it two separate ones? Is there an understanding like, yo, we need to be together here, but we're clear that there may come a moment where y'all gonna have to do what you have to do, and we're gonna have to do what we're gonna have to do.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate setup to the dynamic. There's certainly alignment and solidarity. It is important to note that the organizing community is who put Brandon Johnson in office.
I know I followed
His
it.
candidacy, he was polling at 2 and 3%, and it was really the infrastructure of the grassroots campaigns against police violence, for mental health, for housing, that really was the infrastructure of his campaign. And so with that, I think there was definitely some learning lessons of the first year and a half. I think there was some courting of like the Democratic establishment, and there was some maneuvering because we had the Democratic National Convention here. But really, these past few months, we've been very proud of him. And this past week, he has, what we could call like a anti-Trump cut city budget that is putting a pause on the way overtime practices happen with the police department, is making really important investment into some of our mental health infrastructure, and is really pushing for new and innovative ways to tax corporations and tax the rich. And so that has been in alignment with our coalition, and there have been folks from movement that have, gone into City Hall and are, I think these last few months really pushed through some important things. And at the same time, we are proud of him for how he's standing up against this fascist moment and against this president, and particularly that call for a general strike is the right type of messaging we want to see from an elected official. Like they are
You know that's where I'm going next.
they're not our
You know that's where I'm
heroes,
going next.
but
Listen, I was like, come on, then,
that's
Brandon.
about
Come
as
on,
best as we
then.
can expect. So yeah, in
Yeah.
this season right now, people had love and appreciation for him, the man, but like we're trying to see him get his footing, and we're had some concerns and some skepticisms, and I've heard from dozens and dozens of people like, oh, I'm so proud. I'm so confident. There's a boost in how he's responding to this moment that we want to highlight.
I mean, I ain't even in Chicago, and I was listening to the man this morning on a look. I'm my eyes welling up, and I actually, I was listening to him on the news this morning, and getting ready to talk to you, and it was about the budget. By the way, y'all, that Damon's referring to is called the Protecting Chicago Budget. It's a $16 billion budget that purports to protect things like Medicaid, youth employment, mental health for first responders. And I had this moment, right, as someone who's a student of history and student of folks that get thrown into the fire, because our real soldiers actually don't choose it. If you wake up and you decide you want to be, in the center of the storm, you're the people that the people need to run away from. But I sat, I was watching him, and I could feel just the weight on this man's shoulder of this moment and what he's carrying, and the gleam of his wedding ring caught. I mean, this is a family, this is a man that is standing up in this moment. And I just had mad respect. Is he going to do everything right or everything the way we want? No, right? But he's navigating some really serious waters. And I don't think we do enough. We do such a good job at the left of tearing down our people that put themselves in the fray that I just want to take a moment and lift up that black man for the fray that he's standing in the middle of.
I agree. I have love for him.
I see. We have Anna Wilcox has joined us from Portland, and I'm going to get right to you. One of the things, Damon, that the mayor did early on was sign an executive order forbidding the Chicago Police Department. We talked about this a little bit last time you were on the show, from working with ICE and the National Guard. Mm-hmm. Wondering how that's going. What his executive director, however, his executive directive could not do, however, was stop the Illinois State Police from working with federal agents. How's that going? That's some disturbing pictures.
Yeah, that is a concern. I would say so far we don't have any documented cases of CPD disregarding that order. So that is, you know, something to stand on. But yes, there are other police agencies that have jurisdiction in our area. So the state police is one that we've seen collaboration. And then also there, you know, they are moving countywide. So like most of our cities, there are people that are Chicago or Chicagoland or Chicago adjacent that aren't in our like actual city boundaries. And we're seeing many of those municipalities function different than the order that the mayor brought down, which is of concern. And one thing I just also want to add for other cities that are looking at Chicago that is not getting attention to this attack is that it's not only the military occupation. There's also a political attack that is explicitly connected to this siege or to this takeover. And so we were on the edge of having an extension of our red line train because there are 4.5 miles of the south side that don't have access to our train system. And the federal government's denied that funding or withdrew that funding at the last minute of naming we can't support anything that helps a race-based policy. So basically they named that because this train will help black people, it is now something that we are opposing. They also pulled out $8 million from our public schools. So when we talk about that budget, it's an important stopgap because the attack is not just troops and tear gas and batons and body cameras. It's also attacking our infrastructure in a way that I think will be mirrored in other cities. So we have to do more than just stand up and just resist and do the mutual aid. We also have to keep an eye on what's happening to our infrastructure and then make commitments to counteract that over time.
I'll add to that, because your mayor is also in court around those dollars that Trump has cut federal funds out of Chicago, which include the natural disaster hit Chicago. All that money's gone, right? Things that cities need to be able to rapidly respond to crisis. Last question for you, David, before I move on to Portland. How are the No Kings marches in Chicago and are black organizers extracting from that moment, this moment? What is the conversations between black organizing and No Kings organizing?
I think the conversations are happening and happening slowly a little bit, but not in like a contentious way. I think, you know, what that project is important. There are people who have not been activated or there are masses of folks that, you know, have an opinion or stand in opposition that, you know, we are not in a space to absorb all or also might not be all of our focus. And so it's an important stance. And I think there were a lot of movement that was present and spoke and helped, you know, give shaping to the messaging of that moment. And we're really excited about it. And I think the conversations and the connections are ongoing. So my mentor, in many ways, someone I look to for leadership, Dr. Barbara Ransby, has been in communication with a lot of those leaders. And so, you know, we're making those connections and we were happy to see that turnout.
Right. Well, I mean, let's stay in contact. Listen, the analysis is accurate. I love how diplomatic you are. You don't understand a diplomatic show. You know, we sort of call it what it is on the show.
Okay. I know.
Yeah. We just call it what it is. And, right, like my latest Facebook post was organize or shut up because the analysis is what it is. And, right, so what are we going to do about it? Because that's where the people are, right? Now, what I think about people that want Obama and Biden's America back, not about them, but about that politic. I don't have any use for that America. But if there are 10,000 people in one corner block of my city, that's where I'm going. And my job is to extract who and what I can from that political moment and help funnel them people into something a little more beneficial for the America that I'm trying to build in partnership with comrades like you. All right, Damon, I'm going to let you go. I'll holler at you soon, my G.
Appreciate you. I'm always down to come back home. And much love to Portland. Y'all have a good time.
All right. Thanks, Damon.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.